partly all to say thank you, because I think a few of you have made a conscious effort to move a little bit forward. We have filled the room, so it's a little hard to tell you did that, but some of you have done that, and I do appreciate it. I hope that you will continue to do that. We are working on getting ready to study Revelation. I'm starting to realize that Jody's wearing thin because he has to watch that Revelation as we But in the process of doing that, we have talked about the symbolism and some of the likely explanations or general explanations for some of that symbolism. We've talked about colors, we've talked about numbers, we've talked a bit about living creatures and the fact that there's also beasts that are mentioned from time to time. There are a couple of other figures that you need to know about. And those of you who are taking notes, you can take notes more furiously at the end of this list and less furiously at the front of this list. But if you walk through apocalyptic literature in general and Revelation in particular, you will see references to throne and thrones. I counted in chapter 4, which is a fairly short chapter, there's about a dozen times the word throne appears just in that one chapter. There are either all-seeing eyes or eyes all around a creature that sort of has the same effect. Rainbows, hearts show up, and obviously seals and trumpets and bowls and things of that sort show up. As do precious metals, jewels, and all of that. Be aware of those to the extent we need to work on those. We will do that when we get there. But there are two symbols in this sort of others list that you need to have more information about. The first of these is earth, and the second of these is ocean or sea. Usually in my translation, it's the word sea. You need to understand when you read this, earth is less the physical planet earth, and it is more the seat of man's false religion. When you see commentary about earth itself, when you see it specified, very often what's being talked about is the center of the false religion human beings put together. And the sea is the center or the seat of man's false or corrupt government. When you read through Revelation, there are beasts that emerge out of the sea, and they have horns. The horns seem to represent political leaders, so that sometimes you see one and sometimes you see several, and that has been correlated to events in the past and perhaps should be more preferably correlated to events still in the future. We're going to talk about that for a little while this morning. But you see these beasts, and remember, beast is not the same as living creatures. You see these beasts, and they're emerging from the sea, and that image is telling you this is the kind of government that human beings set up that is corrupt or false, and not the kind of government that God considers what he wants his people to have permanently. And in the same kind of way, the earth becomes that seat or source of man's false religion. And thus it is, if you'll turn very briefly to the end of Revelation, and take a look at the first verse of chapter 21, you may get a very different reading on the words that are here. And as we said several weeks ago, the Western literal mind wants to make a certain interpretation of this verse. But if you think about what I just said, a different interpretation may be provided. Chapter 21 in Revelation, verse 1, I then saw a new heaven and a new earth. The first heaven and the first earth had disappeared now, and there was no longer any sea. No longer any sea. Does that mean water has disappeared? Maybe. If this other is right, what does it mean? There's no more source of this corrupt government. A different kind of government has now been put in place. False religions, the kind of religion that man puts together without regard to God, those are put away, and something new is in its place. And if you take a look at the description of the throne, this is God's throne in chapter 4. Remember, I told you how many times the word throne appears there. If you take a look at verse 1, I think we talked about this briefly last time. In my vision, I saw a door open in heaven, and I heard the same voice speaking to me, a voice like a trumpet saying, come up here, I will show you what will take place in the future. And with that, I fell into ecstasy, and I saw a throne standing in heaven, and the one who was sitting on the throne, and it goes on to describe him. And if you come down to verse 6, what's found in front of the throne?
Something like a sea of glass.
Something like a sea, as if a glass, transparent and crystal. Does that mean that there is a giant ocean-sized piece of glass that looks like crystal somewhere, sometime? Maybe. But it also could mean, and probably does mean, that there is a different kind of government that emerges from this throne than has emerged from the other throne at any time. And so, it's those two things that I want to make sure that you've seen in addition to all the other symbolism. When we finish that, we're almost ready to start. What verse represent?
Being
a force of the false religions, the corrupt religions that human beings put together without regard to God. And the sea represents the force of all government. So, or governments that are not in accord with or connected with. With God's name. Okay. Now, last week you had an assignment. I understand that I was supposed to ask Mary Ann what she found when she looked for it for me. Rather.
Okay. Well, I found...
Just the short version. Just the short version. The central piece of it.
It's very short. A Christian who believes in providence.
I thought that was about as good a definition as I did. Preterism is a Christian who believes in preterism. Did that help anybody? Didn't help Marianne either. To the extent that there are trends or themes in the way people react to this book, these words summarize sort of the three big ones. Okay? I gave you preterists because it's more likely you'll find something useful if you find it. Obviously, it is not certain that you will, but it is at least likely. Did anyone find anything? Can you summarize it briefly? Go ahead.
I
Okay, not bad. Anybody want to add something to that? Yes.
This is the school of thought that says that most of the events of the revelation have already taken place in the first century. In other words, it's not something to look forward to, but it's already done. I think it has to do with the ruler of Nero, who was probably like the beast or something.
So this is a view which says that what is described in Revelation is in something that is in the past and actually in the time of the writer or the time immediately past the time the writer was read.
AD 70, when it took place, it was not a literal second coming of Christ, but a spiritual coming, because it occurred
The power of the destruction of Jerusalem in the lives of the Christians who had been Jewish was so powerful that many of them saw the fulfillment of most of what Revelation talks about in that event and in the echoes that came in the years and decades immediately after. So the preterist piece says, that what Revelation is describing is essentially a description of things that were happening or were completed at or just after the time that, that this was being written.
Yeah. I have a question. That
the Jews
were expecting
the Messiah
to come, and that
already,
maybe they think they saw the Messiah. They didn't
believe in Jesus. Nothing I have said suggests that there are no problems with this evening. So remember, we're talking mostly about Christian viewpoints, not Jewish viewpoints. We're talking about Christian viewpoints. Christian viewpoint would be if they tell this, that the events described, that the words of Revelation are describing events that are, from our perspective, in the far distant past and were completed.
So that wasn't Jewish before that, that was Christian.
Yeah, these are people who are trying to make sense out of what Revelation says. Some hold this view. That it is helpful, I think, for you to know that there are some who hold that view. In our day, we're talking about views that might be described in the last week, now and maybe in the last couple of hundred years.
Are they dominant in any particular
I think there is an answer to that. I don't think I feel confident to give it. I don't think the groups that you are likely to encounter are here. The groups you're likely to encounter are elsewhere. I put a sign on the form that says warning dangerous sound that I'm supposed to keep a foot on the bag whenever I say something that is outrageous or provocative or otherwise inflaming. It seems to modify the violence of the reaction. Historical. We're still on track. This is not pettering. Those of you who may have been perfectly in saying something I wasn't saying, this isn't pettering, this isn't child language, that sort of thing. This is rather, it has to do with the past in that case.
And of course, I couldn't find anything in my high conviction theology. Of course, I had to go over the internet. So I wrote to three theologian friends to see what they would share with me. I heard from two of them. One of them, Dr. Buzz, that one said he'd never heard of the term. Never heard of it. That's very interesting. The other one I wrote to was a former seminary president who grew up in Kentucky. He first heard the term back in the 40s, but in an English grammar class in high school. So,
did it have a different meaning in those things? And that's why I get to the Carol to show those words. I've not heard a big pair of words, but past completed is a pretty darn good summary of that issue.
So there's two past tenses. One of them is called the present, and the rule for it is a completed past tense. I went to the story the
other day. We're all listening. Anybody else want to take a whack at the past completed. And the picture is that what Revelation talks about are events that were completed in the far distant past, and that they were completed during the time that this was written or were in the process of being completed within the years immediately following. That is, that you can point to it in the Seleucids and Alexander the Great and other things like this, and sort of walk your way across the apocalypse and the literature from Daniel and Ezekiel and echoes in other places right up until the time shortly after the Revelation, just sort of line everything up, and then it's done and over with. Okay? Historic.
These are three different words in which you gave us last week.
Yeah, I know. I've got some other words coming. One of those words was this word, right? Okay, we don't need that word yet. We need these words first. What was the other word I gave you? Good. I didn't think this would do you any good at all. I mean, people who go to the internet and look for this word are not going to find anything connected to Revelation anyway. They might find this one, they might find this one, so I didn't give you this one last week. The viewpoint, the historical viewpoint of Revelation, and again, I'm using that word in a technical sense, that viewpoint says it was in the future as far as the writer was concerned, but it's in the past now. When the writer was writing, it wasn't here yet, and it wasn't close. But it's over now. That turns out to be, Bruce, even harder to line up with the correct thing. The future of people from this trend, I think, is fairly easy to see. It's what says. It's mostly or all in our future. Okay, so this is its endpoint. Their future, but our past. And future is mostly, if not almost all, in our future. Okay, now, let me just comment on this one for a moment. There may be, in the minds of people who hold this view, there may be models or preliminary versions of these events, but the events themselves are still largely or completely in the future. Literal futurists, literal futurists, take what they read and plot out a timeline. I can see the future, this is what's going to happen, this is how it's going to unfold, and this is when, and sometimes this is who is on the current stage to make it work. The problem with that group, of whom we still have members today, is that they've been at work long enough, different examples of that, that so far the ones who lay down a prediction of the future, it doesn't work. And the best of them, I use the word best in a very negative sense, the best of them have a way of revising their timeline. So that at any given moment, the timeline still looks like it might happen. But if you go back and look at the timelines that were published, timelines that hopefully they've destroyed all the copies of, then you can't go back and look at that. You start to see the flaw. Jesus himself said, nobody knows when all this is going to happen. And so consequently, I'm going to be firmly on here and say something totally outrageous. This is the group I have the most trouble with, personally. The group that says, we know what's going to happen and when it happens. There's a lot of folks short of that, but I have less trouble. But there are groups that say this is what's going to happen. You will see, if you look in history, you will see groups that would have gathered at a certain place at a certain time because that's the day the Lord is going to return. So they're up on the mountain watching them come back, and if you know, you have to walk down off the mountain. But they're going, okay, I'm going to make this mistake, and now it's going to be Thursday in February, 3 years from now, it's all together again. And then they gather about 6 times before the movement collapses. Movements that have not collapsed are still with us. But this idea of still in our future, one variation on it, I've decided not to use the word perversion of this, but rather to use the word variation. I'd rather not use the word perversion of this, because that might get some of you the wrong conversation, so I'm going to say the word perversion. And say, it's in our future, but I know exactly how it's going to come. Those who say it's in our future, but do not try to go beyond what the Lord says. You don't go beyond what He says. Lay out the time better. I get in trouble with that. Very often what happens to literal futurists is that they will identify a particular person who's on the historical stage. When Hitler was here, Hitler was so identified. Stalin was so identified. Now the communists were so identified. And so that Richard Nixon. Putting together that particular group sets up one particular view of things. I suspect that there are those who would be quite happy to identify George W. Bush as one of the things that seem to be good risen in their life. And I certainly think that there might be some who would. But the future is safe, it's in our future. And therefore, there are warning signs and so forth of what you do. I don't want to state out a position except to say that what we're going to talk about for the next few minutes when we get to this work is going to be taking some of the points of view here. And try to help you understand how they're viewing it. So, what is important to know about the word rapture as you do a little homework? What is important? That is the word rapture, as we use it in English language. That is the definition of this word, rapture, written with a lowercase r. We are talking about rapture with an uppercase r, so it will take on some other meanings, but that first definition is helpful. Yes. What is important to know about the word rapture? Notice I'm asking this not what did you learn about it, but what's important to know? Yeah, that's really important. The word rapture is not found in the Bible.
But it's described.
It is a term that people see as collecting points of view that are in the Bible, or collecting descriptions. It's a one word way of capturing things that some people see as needing to be captured in a word. Okay? Now, the piece of this actually goes back into Daniel, which means if you were in the worship service already, you have this hand. You got it talking with somebody yesterday to say that in the 11 o'clock time that we do this class, nearly everybody who's here, if they're going to church, they've been to church. This hour is half and half. So some of you have not been to church this morning. You have not had the pastor tell you to take the brightly colored sheet that you find in your bulletin. Did you see the brightly colored sheet? And to throw it away because he's going to do something wrong with it. You haven't seen that yet. So it means at 11 o'clock, maybe he'll go back and preach to you the sermon he was planning to preach. But a lot of people screw this away pretty much. But he preached out of the book of Daniel. And he worked his way right up to the edge of some of the apocalyptic literature there. But he didn't get to it. He was still in more than the scripted part of that particular book. But if you go back in there, Daniel has a couple of visions, and in those visions, he gets a glimpse of the future, or so it appears. But when he's talking about timelines, he talks about weeks. And people have interpreted the weeks, and a week of years means 7 years. Now, you've got to just accept something to accept that. But he talks about time, that's half a time. And time, they think, means year. So half a time means half a year. And he talks about things that are going to happen that are so terrible, it's unbelievable how terrible it is. And he talks about these things happening for two times at a time and half a time. How many years is that? Two times and a time and half a time. 3.5 years, if you accept those ideas. And there's other things that he talks about having a week of this, which means 7 years. And so, mostly out of Daniel, a little bit out of other places, a view has arisen that there is coming a time on earth that is so terrible, so horrible, that it is unlike any other time that the world has ever seen. And the term that's used for that is tribulation. Is this as bad as you can imagine? Is the time we are living in right now as bad as you can imagine? No. Some aspects of it are terrible. Is it as bad as we can imagine? I don't think so. It's not as bad as Revelation.
Now, I don't find a whole lot in Revelation that gives that timeline, that period of time. But people have taken all the different parts of apocalyptic literature, put it together, and see this. That is, the ones who look for time periods, a 7-year period. And all the references to 3.5 seem to imply that something is going on halfway through. That is, this 7-year period of awful, terrible things is what I mean to pass. This is oversimplified, and it is setting aside some ways of describing it and embracing others for me to say this much. Now, the point that comes, more than anything else, is the notice that some people give of what's contained in the book of Revelation. What's contained in the book of Revelation tends to be a description of these terrible times that you read about in other places. Now, let me pause for just a second, because I'm going to take you to some place that's totally different. We're not going to stay there too long, but I do want to take you there for just a minute. A few weeks ago, maybe 2 weeks ago, we talked very, very briefly about the structure of the book of Matthew. I throw this out every once in a while, hoping that they will come to all of you know the structure of the book of Matthew. Do any of you remember that? Let's try it one more time. The book of Matthew essentially has 7 parts. It has an introduction, that's the first part. It has a conclusion, that's the last part. The introduction talks about Jesus' birth, and to the extent that shepherds and angels and visitations and all this are talked about, that comes in the introductory part. The conclusion part is the arrest and the crucifixion, the things that Kevin was talking about that are in No Distant Movies, and the resurrection. And interactions with his disciples between the time of the resurrection and the ascension. But that's the concluding part. The 5 parts in the middle have a basic structure. There is 2 parts to each of those parts. There's a narrative section. You might call that part A in one of these 5 parts. And then there is an instruction section, if you will. Most of you know about the Sermon on the Mount. The Sermon on the Mount is the instruction section of the first of these middle 5 parts of the book of Matthew. There's a narrative section before that. Jesus goes here and sees this person does this. He goes there and this encounter takes place. This one says this, that one says that. This one does this. This one does that. But at the end of the time, he stops, gathers people together, and begins to instruct the teaching, if you will. And the Sermon on the Mount is the first one. How many parts are there in the middle of the book of Matthew? 5. 1 introduction, 1 conclusion, and 5 of these 2-part sections. Okay? So the Sermon on the Mount is the first. How many more are there?
4 more.
There's 4 more. One of those talks about missionary work. One of those talks about parable. I forget what the 4th one talks about. The 5th one talks about last things. That's when Jesus gets into the edge of some of this apocalypse.
Okay.
So what I want to do is bring that to your attention so you can find the book of Matthew. And again, just look for your notes in your study Bible and find the 5th of those sections for you to find. Now, some of you may have a little trouble doing that, so I will try to help. I tell you, it's chapter 24. That's okay. Now, just to help you a little bit, I'd like you to look at chapter 26. Where did you find 24? When you found that, look at the first verse of chapter 26. What's the first thing he says in the first part of chapter 26, verse 1? When Jesus has finished all he wanted to say. That's the clue that you reach the end of one of the teaching sections. That set of words, or a set of words very much like it, appears 5 times in the book of Matthew. And every time it appears, it's closing one of the teaching sections. So if you go to the end of the Sermon on the Mount, where's the Sermon on the Mount?
5 through 7.
So it'll either be the last verse in 7, the last couple of verses in 7, or even the first verse in 8. It happens to be the next to the last verse in chapter 7. With respect to verse 28 in chapter 7. Jesus is now finished 21, so that's the end of the teaching section for the Sermon on the Mount. Is that still okay? Alright, so from chapter 24, which is the start of the teaching section, up to
the end of chapter 25, this is Jesus talking about last things. He's talking about, if you will, the end of the world. Jesus answered them, Jesus left the temple, verse 1 of chapter 24. His disciples came up and drew his attention to the temple building. You can imagine a sunset lighting up those buildings. You can imagine the beauty of it. Let's have a little pop quiz here for just a moment. If you went to church at the 8 o'clock hour, would you write the answer to study? Good. What were the opening words of what the choir sang? Now, quite really sang one. It was accompanying some people on the other. Open now thy gates. We've got choir members in the room. Open now thy gates of you. Zion, something. His disciples drew his attention to the temple building. I'm certain things that you look how beautiful they are. And he said to them in reply, you see all these, I tell you in truth, not a single stone here will be left on top of another, and will be pulled down. And while he was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him and asked him when they were by themselves, tell us, when is this going to happen? What signs will there be of your coming and of the end of the world? And Jesus, in that point, begins for the next three chapters to answer that question. Take care that no one deceives you. Many will come using my name and say, I am the Christ, and will deceive many. You will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are alarmed, for this is something that must happen, but the end will not be yet. For nation will fight against nation, kingdom against kingdom, famines, earthquakes in various places, and all this is only the beginning. You will be handed over to the torture and put to death. You will be hated by all nations on account of my name. Many will fall away. People will betray one another and hate one another. False prophets will arise and deceive many. With the increase of lawlessness, love in most people will grow cold, but anyone who stands firm to the end will be saved. And then a line that the mission board takes as one of its major directions. The good news of the kingdom will be proclaimed to the whole world as evidence to the nation, and then the end will come. Now, there are lines in here that give you some sense of what he's talking about. Take a look at verse 22. If that time had not been shortened, no human being would have survived. But shortened, that time will be for the sake of those who are chosen. And he just goes on and talks about these kinds of things. Now, at the end, Jesus brings them back to a parable that reoriented them to say, basically, don't be spending your time worrying about what is coming. Spend your time doing the things God's called you to do until that time comes. But you're not going to know when the time is coming. And I think that's good words for all of us here. Do not obsess on the book of Revelation and the wondering about whether all these things are going to happen if they are in our future. Spend instead your efforts being what God wants you to be, doing what God wants you to do, serving as God wants you to serve in the places that He calls you to. So, we come back to this. Now, Daniel, in other places, we see a timeline. In Revelation, we see a horrible time that seems like we're talking about the same time. But what is noticed is, if you look, the church is dominant in the first three chapters. The church is visible in the fourth and fifth chapters, but not on earth. The picture is the church is in heaven. And starting in chapter 6, and running almost to the end of the book, the church isn't mentioned at all. And some commentators a couple hundred years ago noticed this and said, church isn't mentioned at all. There are a few witnesses that are mentioned, but the church is never mentioned. Must be that the church is not fixed. So where did they go? And people at this point went back to Thessalonians. And Thessalonians is a little book toward the end of Paul's letters, and you're challenged to have to find Thessalonians. There are two of them I want you to find the first one. I'll take my time getting there so that you can have a chance to catch up with me. If you see first and second Timothy, you're talking too far. First Timothy chapter 4. First Thessalonians.
Verse 13. And I'm going to take a moment before we start talking about what we want to talk about, just to point out the Paul's instruction here. You walk through Paul's letter and mark the places where he says, about this, we want you to be absolutely certain. Or, I want to make sure you are certain about this. There's this wonderful phrase, I don't want you ignorant about that. Those become some of the high watermark of Paul's teachings. These are things that Christians should, if you're going to begin your study somewhere, sometimes my students ask me, what should I study for the test? And I tell them, well, think about all the things that we talked about and ask yourself, which ones do you think are the most important things? And write those down on the list. And as you're getting this list, you might find some things. Yeah, they're important. They're not as important as those. Write those down on the second list. And you might run across a few and say, you know, mostly that was background and context to help you understand this. Write that down on the third list. That's what he said. This is Paul's way of marking those things out. So this is one of the big ones. We want you to be quite certain, brothers. Why did he say we? I thought this was Paul right here. Why did he say I? That's my second little aside comment. It says, so Paul wrote very few of these letters by himself. If you look in the end of many of the letters, you will see that Paul is getting greetings from the people, from himself and from the people who are with him, and very often it's silence, or it's somebody else like that who is with Paul, and Paul is writing for these. In fact, sometimes at the front of the letter, the Latin from Paul and from Silvanus, is the Latin form of Silas, and you'll see. So sometimes we see an editorial, we assume there's more than one person writing. We think that it's Paul's letters, but he's the one common among them. We want you to be quite certain, brothers, now it's time for us to start, about those who have fallen asleep. What have fallen asleep? Dead citizens. To make sure you do not grieve for them, the sentence does not end there. To make sure you do not grieve for them as others do who have no hope. If you lose a loved one to death, do you grieve? You bet. And it can be hard. It can be terribly hard. I got a student at the university this week who missed one of my classes. Her grandfather had died. And I asked her, was this a time of grieving or a time of celebration? And she looked at me funny and said, I hadn't thought about that. We were grieving, but yeah, he was 85, he had had a great life, we were celebrating. But sometimes it's hard to celebrate. But Christians still do not grieve the way people do who have no hope. And so Paul says, let me now explain to you what I mean by that. Here's what I mean. We believe Jesus died and rose again, and that in the same way God will bring with him those who have fallen asleep in Jesus. That is, those who are believing. We can tell you this from the Lord's Day. If we are still alive, the Lord's coming will not have any advantage over those who have fallen asleep. At the signal given by the voice of the archangel and the shout of the God, the Lord himself will come down from heaven. And those who have died in Christ will be first arise, and only after that shall we who remain alive be taken up in the clouds together with them to meet the Lord in the air. This is the way we shall be with the Lord forever with thoughts such as these. Then you should encourage one another. Where is the believer to meet the Lord? According to this verse 7. Is that not? In the clouds in the air. And the Lord says that Jesus comes, not to the earth, but to the air. And the believers join him in the air and leave. And the people who look at Revelation see no vision of the church past chapter 3 except visions of the church in heaven. Individual witness is yes, but not the church. Believe, okay, the church has been taken out, and that long is probably told us how. And so their picture is that Jesus returns not once, but twice. Once to take the believers out, and then again, chapter 19 of Revelation, when he comes back in power to have the battle to return by the time of the day. And the word rapture has been used so that there's a single word that takes that whole idea and wraps it up. Okay? Now, what's the first important thing to know about the word rapture with capital R? Not Bible. Okay? What's the second important thing? It is a picture that expresses the belief of many people that Jesus is going to return once for his church. And then later, to confront Satan.
in the battles that are called Armageddon in the Revelation.
Now, if you're a literal futurist and you want a timeline, what's your question?
When is that going to happen? And the answer is varied from, it's not going to happen at all, you just read it. Two, it's going to happen before this ever starts. Or, it's going to happen halfway through. Or, it'll happen again. Let's review that just for fun. If you are a literal futurist, in which sense you don't have to worry about this part. But if you're a little curious and you get really obsessed with questions like, when is this going to happen? The answers that have been proposed are,
not at all.
Yeah, it ain't going to happen at all. You just read it. That's not what they're talking about here. Right? The word's not there, so the idea's not there. Or, before the tribulation, halfway through the end, or, again, pre-trib, mid-trib, and post-trib. If you don't know those abbreviations, you get lost in the discussion of the ones who are obsessed about this kind of stuff. And it is kind of nice not to be lost when somebody's obsessed in here. Do you think the rapture is going to happen? And if you do, does the fact that you believe it make it so? That's all I can say. If you believe it, the fact that you believe it is not what makes it so. What makes it so is because God is that to happen. There are enough clues here that my suggestion to you is, do not dismiss the idea. Do not dismiss the idea. I'm not going to force you to embrace it, but do not dismiss the idea. There's enough evidence here that I think the idea has merit. And do not heaven's place, do not dismiss those who believe. But I will tell you, there are some who say, well, I read and see and think and hear that it's going to happen before it's going to happen here. Most of the ones that you hear, the ones who are vocal enough to get their voice to you, are going to be pre-tribulation millennialists. Millennial is something else, what I talked about the other day, that the church is gone before any of this starts. And they're basing that on the absence of the word church and the description of church in that middle part of Revelation. Okay. We're getting real close to being ready to talk about in fact, I think we'll start next week. I think we'll start next week. Okay. So your assignment for next week is twofold. One is for next week itself. For next week itself, I want you to read the first chapter of Revelation again. If you've been reading it, that's wonderful. It will not hurt you to read it again. Especially read the description of John's vision of Jesus in the second half of the first chapter. If you want to know where it starts, you can look at verse 12 of chapter 1 of Revelation, and it says, I turned around to see who was speaking to me, and when I turned around, I saw him. And what he saw is a picture of the risen Lord. I want you to look through there and just make a list of the descriptive terms. I want you to make a list of the descriptive terms and ask yourself, what does each one tell you about Jesus? Does it tell you that he has a sword sticking out of his mouth? Is the risen Lord going to have a physical sword sticking out of his mouth? If so, what's it made of? If so, how long is it? And so on like that. But if it symbolizes something, then what's it symbolizing? I think it's probably symbolizing something. So look at those scriptures. Second thing I want you to do is I want you to look at the letters to the churches that start in chapter 2 and chapter 3. And here's your assignment. There's seven of them. I want you to see if you can find, by reading the letters and comparing one to the other, what is common in the structure of the letters. A good commentary will probably do this for you if you want to consult the commentary. The letters have a structure that is in common. They have certain parts. Look at those parts and see if you can see what the parts of the letter are. That'll get you ready for things that we'll do a couple weeks. Next week we're going to talk about pictures of the Lord, what those symbols mean, what they tell us about Jesus. And then the week after that, I think, we're going to start working through the letters. And the first thing we want to do with the letter is to get an idea of the common structure. And so I invite you to be present when we do that. Let's have a word of prayer today. Our Father, the most important thing we learn in Revelation is that you love us, that you care about us, and that you have eternal plans for those who are faithful to you. And more than that, we learn that you want everyone to be faithful to you, and that your heart is broken when there are people who rebel and turn their back. Help us be the instruments of your power for the world, to bring your knowledge to others. But show us how to do that in a way that's attractive and not repellent. In a way that's effective and not ineffective. Teach us how to do that in our hearts. We pray.